Welcome to another episode of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our ongoing conversations about the cultures of consciousness. And I love it when the guest of the day totally aligns with the ethos and aesthetic of this show. Today we're going to be talking with Anthony Alvarado, whose work I first encountered in the late, great Arthur magazine, that I also contributed to at times. And his column on DIY magic really grabbed me because it was one of the best exemplars, as is his new book that collects and extends his collection of his approach towards generating and exploring magic, which we can define a little bit more in a second, in ordinary life. What really struck me is how much it represents what I think is a really significant change that's going on, which is the stripping away of a lot of the kind of balderdash and exotica from esoteric and magical practices, and the reformulating of them for a more immediate, hands-on, consciousness hacking kind of approach. And there's a bunch of consequences of that. Some of them, not all of them, are great in terms of the kind of inspiration that these things can provide to go beyond our ordinary egos. And when magical practices or mystical techniques are made too available to the ordinary ego, sometimes a kind of repetition of the same happens. In earlier shows, we've talked about mindfulness, for example, this wonderful tradition within a Buddhist practice. But we've talked about how, as it has become more and more popular and more mainstreamed, it's lost its radical edge, and mindfulness then becomes an extension of the workaday ego, the one who wants to do the business meeting better, the one who wants to overcome anxiety so they can just, you know, make more money or whatever it is. And there's always that slippery slope when things are taken away from their exotic mystical packaging and presented to individuals. But what Anthony does is he's doing it not in the spirit of expanding the ordinary self, but really encouraging us all to recognize that we already have all the tools we need to explore. And that yearning we often have, we feel our life is dull or we're kind of locked in a groove and we need some big thing to shake us up, or, you know, an expensive vacation, or, you know, some new, you know, whatever, religious cult, or some, you know, massive, you know, illegal drug binge or something like that, that actually a lot of what we really need and are seeking and want creatively, experientially, spiritually, is really very close to us. It's right at our fingertips. It's right in the fabric of our ordinary day, of how we walk down the street, of how we wake up in the morning, of how we you know, drink coffee, of how we talk to people, of how we look at landscapes or birds in the sky. And so Anthony presents just a wonderful series of very accessible and wittily described practices and experiments in terms of expanding our capacities for, I guess, what you could call ordinary magic. This isn't the magic of, you know, ceremonial Kabbalah or, you know, heavy-duty jungle mystagoguery. This is the magic. It's more of a secular magic that I see as kind of emerging from a long line of, certainly, of 20th century artists and thinkers. So it's more about surrealism and Dada and psychoanalysis and Jung and hippies than it is about a kind of more esoteric or sort of historically informed mode of occultism, and for that reason, I think it still has a lot of potential, both to speak to people who aren't interested in the occult as a sort of historical system, but people who are interested in shaking up the everyday for whatever reason, for creativity, for escape, for expansion, and simply for being able to know the capacities of the self, and how powerful subtle nearby experiences can be, which, as listeners to the show know, is increasingly a kind of theme of mine, the sort of realm of subtle allies and ordinary magic. So I'm really looking forward to our conversation with Anthony today. But before we bring him on, of course, we're going to invite our co-host here on Expanding Mind, someone I know who was had some influence on Anthony's own work, the White Witch of L.A., Maja Dao. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric. Yeah, I was so excited when Anthony gave me his book because it's great. It's just really practical, so it has a lot of, it's almost like one of those rainy day books, you know, like when you're a kid you would get those little project books, and it reads a lot like one of those little kid rainy day books in the way that you can just like pull it out and do it right there, like it's something that's applicable. Like a lot of people will think magic or some kind of spirituality that it's always this big ordeal and you have to, like, you know, shave your head and fast for 3 months, which of course those are always options, but you can also do these little shifts of your perception using these little, like, psychomagic tricks on a daily basis. And there's so much good, helpful stuff in there that's just, you know, helps make this kind of stuff accessible to people so that people can kind of practice using parts of their brain they just don't usually get into.
Yeah, I mean, I just, and even saying the thing about parts of the brain, I think is really key, in that we're at this age of, you know, pervasive neuroscientific ideas and discoveries, and, you know, more and more we can't help but see ourselves as, and our experience as being in many ways produced by the brain. But that means that the brain is something else that can be played with. In Mikey Spiegel's terms, you know, consciousness can be hacked. And that sense of like, okay, I've come into the world with. Let's see what happens when I get my fingers on the knobs and the buttons. Right. And directing that in a creative way is, I think a very powerful and very entertaining way to spend one's time. So with that, let's bring Anthony onto the show. Anthony, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here talking with you guys.
Yeah, it's really a fun book, and I hope it goes far, because I in a lot of ways you're doing in a much more accessible way a lot of the kinds of ideas that have been in my mind in terms of emphasizing this kind of the proximity of ordinary magic, and that a lot of this stuff is really just very, very close to home. It all requires is a slight shift, and then these worlds begin to open up. But, you know, the kind of obvious place to start is when did you start compiling the stuff, working on these things?
You know, I feel like when I started, it didn't feel very accessible. I was, as a teenager, I'd be in the library exploring different books, and I was always very interested in the occult, the paranormal, and in trying to wrap my head around these different ideas that didn't fit into the mainstream definition of the world and reality. But I felt like there was this veil of kind of like a click, like I didn't speak the right lingo and I couldn't understand. You have to learn this whole lingo to get into many systems of magic. And so this DIY magic is sort of my attempt to, make it much more accessible and to, as you were saying in the introduction, strip away some of the, I feel, are like layers of an accretion of symbols and meanings, and the history of the Colton of Magic is this palimpsest of different people's interpretations. And I feel like it's a great time right now to try to get back to the basics, to get at the raw intuition that's behind it. But to get back to your question, how I really, where I think I got started and moved from just reading about it in books to really thinking, how can I experience a different realities? How can I shift my perception? Well, I was working in Portland at a mental health facility downtown, and I'd be working with a lot of clients there who lived there who otherwise would probably be out on the streets, and a lot of them had schizophrenia and various mental illnesses, and they had approached me with problems involving, you know, there's a 7-foot horse that is bothering me, you know, something that was totally unworldly, and I would have to try to help problem solve with them on how to help them deal with these kind of strange and impossible beings. And that really got me thinking about, well, what their reality is so different than mine. What makes my reality the right reality, the correct one, and what allows us all to agree on this sort of consensual reality? And that experience of working with people who saw things so differently really got me started in trying to see how wiggly reality could be, how wiggly my perception of reality could be. And what I feel like I've found, and what people have been saying all along for centuries, is that if you change your perception, you are essentially, in effect, really changing your reality. And the two are on equal sides of the equation, your perception and your reality. And if you adjust one, you adjust the other. It's as simple as a math equation in algebra.
You know, what I also appreciate, though, and particularly in the example of the people you were with mental illness that you were working with, is that it's not just about changing your own perception. It's also about changing your own perception so that you can encounter new things in the world. You know, there's sometimes when we talk about how, you know, you can change your perception and change reality, or the new age thing, you know, you create your own reality. It gets really narcissistic and kind of self-enfolded. And obviously some of the things we're talking about here really involve going within, you know, whether exploring dream states or isolation tanks or, you know, internal reveries that do involve going into the self. But there's also the sense in a lot of your examples or your exercises or experiments of how you can kind of get yourself involved in the world in a different way, involved with people even in a different way. And the experiment that comes out of your experience with the mentally ill, schizophrenia as oracles, is one of my favorite chapters in there, partly because it was something that I've noticed and I've done, tried to do in my life. I remember, you know, decades ago, noticing when I first moved to New York City, noticing that if I paid attention to what you know, homeless people, so-called seemingly schizophrenic, crazy people were saying on my periphery as I walked down the street, that oftentimes it was oracular. They would speak a thought that I just had. Sometimes it was extremely uncanny. And particularly when I would actually have direct encounters where they would talk to me or talk to me directly, but they were, you know, it was word salad. But if I listened to the word salad, I'd often notice that there was something there. And that really shifted me, because it wasn't just like, you know, how could they know? But it just gave me a sense of how open-ended the field of our realities are. But that then encouraged me to do the more difficult thing, which was to then when I engage with people on the street, and then you talk about this in your experiment as well, is to actually really engage them, to face your fear, to overcome the habit of ignoring them, and to really try to engage even if you can't find the language. And I've had a number of really powerful, sometimes a little scary, but really powerful and revelatory moments of connection with other people by doing this kind of practice. And it really, until I read your book, I never thought about it even as like how it fits in with like my own larger quest to have more magic in my life. And I was like, oh wait, that's actually part of that worldview. That's part of that world of claiming the edges of consciousness as a place where something really profound can happen between people as well as between states of mind.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of a great metaphor for understanding magic in general, because so the thing we're talking about in my book is this idea, if somebody on the street that is maybe responding to voices and they seem just crazy, and normally your response might be to walk to the other side of the street and ignore them, but to instead engage with that person and really try to understand what they're saying. And even if it's word salad, you can have a human connection. And I think that by and large, people kind of have the same feeling when they approach the idea of magic. Well, oh, that's crazy, and it's gobbledygook, and I can't wrap my mind around this book or this idea or this experience or this weird dream I had, so I'm just going to ignore it. I'm going to walk to the other side of the street. But if you try to interact with these kind of peripheral experiences on their own terms, then they open up to you, and you find that it's a language that you know, maybe without even having known that you've known it.
Exactly. No, there's something really basic that gets kicked up. I mean, I'm just following the train of associations, but you use the word peripheral there. And a really good example in my experience of how close this stuff is your vision. So you're looking out, you got your both eyes open, and of course in the center field everything is as nice, three-dimensional, clearly defined objects are popping, and of course that's where most of your interests are. You're looking forward, you're looking at the thing you want. This is what I want, this is what I have to deal with, these are the stairs I have to go down, blah blah blah. But meanwhile there's always this peripheral vision.
Yeah.
And some magicians I know talk about that there's a kind of vision magic where what you're doing is precisely cultivating the peripheral. Like literally right now, if you go to the edge of your vision, there's this kind of spooky territory like Twilight Land where you're not really sure, am I seeing something? Is it fuzzy? Where does the edge of it lie? And a lot of the mysteries that you're pointing towards, this kind of realm of ordinary magic, it lies there. It's in the peripheral right now. It's just about shifting the focus of attention away from the normal ego-driven center field, center stage zone.
Yeah, I think that's another great metaphor for what we're talking about. And it works that way with consciousness itself. I feel like there's always stuff on the not only the peripheral of your vision, but in the same way your own mind, you have kind of the central thing, the central aspect or idea, thought that you're focused on at any given moment. But then there's the peripheral stuff. And for example, as we start to fall asleep with hypnagogic imagery, our focus kind of widens, the focus of our mental camera widens, and we start to, the camera slides off to the side and we get a glimpse of just pure peripheral for a moment. And then I think that intuition works in a similar way, that we often have these intuitions, these ideas that are on the peripheral of what we're thinking about. And we train ourselves, we go through our whole adult lives being so focused on, what's my next objective? What's my goal? What's my list for the day? What am I trying to get to in the next 5 minutes, and we lose touch with that peripheral vision. But I think that it's something that with practice and with doing different techniques, you can widen that vision of your own awareness so that you become a more intuitive person. And then that's something that's just there all the time. Actually, I had a really crazy experience last night where I feel like my intuition saved me from being hit by a car. Because I take a 1 mile walk every night at the end of the day around. There's a loop by my house. And I always go the same direction. I go counterclockwise, and I've gone the exact same route the last, years. And last night, I was halfway done with the route. And then for some reason, I thought, I'm going to turn around right now. I'm going to go not finish the route. I'm going to go backwards. And I felt strange. I didn't know. There wasn't a logical, rational reason for that. It was just an intuition. I didn't even think about it like that. I just turned around and walked back. And then right as I got back to where I crossed the road to walk over to my house, I'm parallel with where I would have come out and been crossing the road if I'd gone full circle. And it's 1 a.m, a car going 50 miles an hour just speeds around the corner. Their lights are off. They pop up onto the curb. They're just driving crazy. And that's exactly where I would have been, should have been crossing the road, had I not, for some strange hunch, just thought, I don't know why I'm going to turn around right here and walk back. So I feel like if you are alert to the peripheral of your awareness, then you get these little nudges that you don't have to make sense of rationally, but they'll help you out for sure.
Yeah, it's funny. Even if they don't help you out, you know, because some people, like, there's a lot of like social science studies that like kind of try to show that people's gut instincts and their so-called intuitions are often wrong, and they have like the elaborate sort of sociobiological explanations, blah blah blah. And, you know, whenever I read those, I'm always like, yeah, but who are they really testing? And what's what's intuition and what's just habit or whatever? It's actually really complicated. But for me, I have another thing to throw in there about why becoming sensitive to your intuition and following it is valuable, and it ties in with another one of your exercises, which you call counting coup, which is basically facing little fears and jumping over them. And what I mean is that I think part of the reason we do stay in rationality and following the lists and following the procedures, ticking off the boxes, is because it's very satisfying. We can hold on to that structure. We know, you know, it's like an algorithm. We do step A, step B, step C. Okay, go back, do step A. And it holds us from the chaos of the world and the terror of who we are and we're going to die and all this, the world's insane, blah, blah, blah. And so when I'm in situations where I feel my intuition, I don't even necessarily believe that it's necessary, that it's going to likely to do me better. I think sometimes it has, but I do know that in order to follow the intuition rather than to follow the plan is scary. And I find that when I face that little micro fear, tiny little fear, but just a little bit, I'm going to go, no, I'm going to follow my gut on this one. Then the other experiences that come from counting coup, as you call it, happen when you face fears and you find that there's this opening, there's a sense of magic, there's a sense of synchronicities can happen. It really changes the way you interact with the world just to face the tiniest little fears.
Yeah, magic is often uncomfortable and kind of scary, and where it leads you can be uncomfortable and kind of scary. I mean, just like talking to somebody who you think is insane, it can be uncomfortable and kind of scary, and yet it teaches us, we learn from it, and it's a valuable thing whether or not we're having fun. But, you know, maybe the point of life isn't to just have fun all the time. But what you were saying about, you know, science poo-pooing this idea of intuition. What a concern of mine is that I think that because magic is taboo, because magic is verboten, I think that whenever these exercises, these ideas do have a tendency to work and to get you somewhere, I think that the scientific framework, the rationale framework wants to kind of readjust the boundaries. And I feel like I see that happening with like Psychology Today type articles where stuff that in my mind to me seems like intuition exercises and magic is kind of being co-opted and presented as, well, it's psychology, it's soft science, because it actually, we can test it in a lab and we've seen this work. And an example that I use in my book is the idea of the power stance, where you stand kind of like a Wonder Woman or Superman stance, where you stand with your hands on your hips and your legs firmly planted, and it generates a feeling of confidence. The idea, there was a famous TED talk that Amy Cuddy did where she suggests that you do this before like a job interview and that sort of thing. And to me, that is, you know, it reminds me more of yoga than of a scientific practice, but I think that's an example of science saying, "Oh, this works and people can do it so easily." We have to rationalize it. We have to explain it in a very rational framework, so that it isn't seen as something that's magical or spiritual or anything like that. But I think that magical techniques can be very practical as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people forget about that because it's gotten tied up in rhetoric or philosophy like you said, part of that is the taboo situation too, where they're like, if I do that, then this will happen. So they're afraid to actually do the practical part and actually participate because, you know, maybe it'll have some kind of repercussion. So having some practical part they can do, where it allows, like you said, the freedom of the intuition to operate instead of, like, having to have all these rules and regulations, like, oh, well, if I do that, then this will happen, or if I do that, then this will happen, instead of just being like, if I do that, let's see what happens.
Yeah.
Which is really about freeing the consciousness to experience things instead of, like, having some kind of predeterministic limiting idea of what exactly the world is, which I think when you do that, it really prevents you from seeing everything like you were talking about.
Yeah, man. Go ahead.
Well, the world is a very, you know, just the experience of life and being alive in this world can be a very startling, crazy feeling when you really just face the, you know, what does it mean to be alive? What does the world mean to be the world? It can be so overwhelming to kind of face that philosophical question in its rawest terms. And so I think that we spend years and years of our lives being indoctrinated. Well, don't worry, we can explain it all. You know, we have
right.
Newtonian physics, we have quantum physics, we have psychology, and this is all something that there's no questions. If you have any doubts, you can look it up on your phone about what this means, and you can define everything. And this sort of like just raw, uninterpreted, unpre-categorized experience is frightening to us. And so I think that we live in a world that's kind of been pre-labeled for us, pre-sorted and arranged, and that keeps us feeling safe. But like we were talking about, sometimes you have to get into a place that's a little bit scary, and then that's a more real way to interact with the world.
I'm happy that you used the word magic in your title, you know, calling it DIY magic, because these things are so stripped of occultism that you know, it would be easy to say, maybe your publisher would go, this is all really great, Anthony,
yeah.
But, you know,
the publisher
why don't we call it self-help creativity or, you know, whatever. But by having the word magic in there, to me, that's probably an invitation to that scariness or that weirdness or that thing that's just a little bit uncomfortable. Whereas, like, creative self-help tips, that's not doing that.
Well, the publisher did suggest that we go with a different title, but I was adamant that we keep it do-it-yourself magic because I feel like, you know, that really is what it is. And I think that, you know, like creativity books right now are very hot. And so I think that there was this idea like, well, let's present this as just a book about creativity, which I do think that it's a great book for creativity, absolutely. I think that there's a ton of overlap in the Venn diagram of the creative musician, the artist, the painter, and the comics artist, and so forth, and the wise person, the wizard, the shaman, the witch. You know, there's a lot of overlap. And in fact, I would say that in our culture, you're no longer allowed to be a witch or a wizard, and so people that would have previously in other cultures been the wise people of the tribe now become the creators of different art medias, because that's where our imagination and make-believe are allowed to still exist. And it's sort of like that has to be kept in this certain boundaries, and then it's okay. You can be as crazy and free as you want to be if it's just self-expression, and we can buy and sell it, you know, depending on what your painting's worth or whatever. But there is this overlap, and so it does kind of work both ways. But I think that it definitely is about magic.
Yeah, I think, I mean, a lot of ways that once you start becoming familiar with the kinds of practices you're talking about and how intimate and immediate a lot of these sort of liminal zones are, and then you go back and look at traditional magic or shamanism or other sort of more developed historical systems, you can sort of see them differently because you can go, oh, wait, this is a way of sort of setting up this kind of stuff or framing these kinds of experiences that are just sort of part of the wiring of human being.
And those older systems, they were very well developed, but they went hand in hand with the culture that they were developed for. And now we're in a weird place where we, you know, most educated people, they understand all these different cultures, which if you were a Siberian shaman, couple thousand years ago, you didn't have that strange perspective necessarily of like of the span of history and of wildly different cultures than, you know, what was near you. And so we are in this kind of, I guess it's postmodernism, right? And so maybe what's necessary is a postmodernistic approach to magic, but that's rather than just taking things from thousands of different places and kind of making this polyglot, this crazy cornucopia, I think that it's good to try to find the similarities, the backbones that are common to all these different practices, and to get really basic about it. And so I've tried to make sort of a really basic cookbook that it could be, you know, the 101 cookbook on if you're first learning how to cook, which you don't want the recipes that are, you know, this is the duck confit that takes 2 weeks to make. You know, you want like how to make a pancake.
Great. Well, we're going to have to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind. We're talking to Anthony Alvarado about DIY magic, and we'll be right back after this message.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dau, and we're here with Eric Davis. Today, we're talking about do-it-yourself magic with Anthony Alvarado. And I was curious, Anthony, since the book's been, you know, available a little while, I wonder if you've gotten feedback, since so much of the nice little quips and tidbits in there are so accessible. Have you heard from friends or people you know, or have people reached out to you to share some of their experiences? Uh-huh. Have you got like flack from it where people were like, dude, what are you talking about? You're crazy. Or how has been like the kind of feedback loop on it? Have you gotten any good stories from it?
Yeah, well, there was only 1,000 copies of the small press edition that Floating World Comics in Portland, Oregon put out. And so those copies have been out for a year. And then now that this new edition, which I spent a year working on, is going to be available, you know, all over the place. So I hope that it makes a larger impact. But yeah, I did get some good feedback from the small press edition. I have taped up on my wall, I just grabbed it, is this letter I got from somebody who read it, who said thanks for writing your book, Anthony. Your philosophy resonates with the way I've always felt about the world in a way I've never experienced before. Reading an articulation of those amorphous, hard-to-pin-down thoughts was really, really nice. I picked up DIY magic on a whim when I was buying comics, and I'm so glad I did. I feel like I've been looking for this book for a long time. Please keep writing, Isabel. Huh. And so I feel like this book has potential to reach people that maybe aren't necessarily shopping in the occult aisle. It's
right.
And there's people out there that, like Isabel, who know that there's more to the world, to the possible experience of the world, but you know, don't quite know how to put it in perspective. And so I hope that this book does resonate with those people and gets people launched on exploring stuff more for themselves. You know, in DIY Magic, I don't talk a whole lot about my own take, you know, on it. Like, I feel like I don't want to hear or I don't want to go on and on about, like, well, here's, you know, here's my experience of, like, a lucid dream, or here's what right. my, you know, experience talking to, you know, my spirit animal or something. Like, I think it's much more interesting to tell you, the readers, like, here's how you can have the experience for yourself, because it's a very subjective territory.
Right. And that's part of leaving it open too, to allow them to kind of experience those experiences without, yeah. you know, having those, all those rules, like, you should see this and you will now see this.
Yeah, right.
Blah, 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 right.
I'm kind of mystified by the books about astral projection that are like, and then you're going to go down like this hallway and,
right.
You know, and I do feel like it, like in my own lucid dreaming experience, I feel like I do encounter the same geography over and over, but I doubt that other people are going to encounter that exact same geography. I think that, you know, that's particular to me, and I like it that way. So, you know, I don't have chapters where I'm going on and on about, well, this is, you know, this is my lucid dreaming geography of what I've encountered. But I do have a chapter on how you, the reader, can get there yourself. And I expect that it's probably going to look different to whoever you are.
Yeah, it's like the occult without cult. Because that's a lot of what happens is, you know, people get together and they start doing these practices together. And then if you develop a shared map, and a lot of what you're doing in like ceremonial magic is you're kind of agreeing on the symbolic universe, and that can be really powerful. But the basic elements of the practices that you're doing don't need that degree of similarity. So in a lot of ways, what you're doing is a kind of like a kinder, gentler chaos magic. You know, chaos magic grew up in the 1970s and 80s. It said, oh, the whole inherited tradition of occultism is just a kind of fabrication and a hierarchical system, and it's kind of oppressive. But we're going to tear it down and realize it's all fiction and start playing with it. And they did it in this super intense kind of post-punk, sort of nihilistic, left-hand path,
right.
kind of intense way. But the actual insight that you don't need that stuff, and in fact you can do it yourself, and that you have all the gear you need already just in your nervous system and your heart, that you're just sort of saying, like, look, here it is, and you don't even need to do all that like crazy post-punk nihilist left-hand path stuff either to have a powerful experience. In some ways it can be very subtle, and it can be very friendly. It's just
yeah,
yeah,
it can be fun too.
We can kind of like become historians of it, or academics of it, to the point of like, well, I was hanging out with these two buddies of mine that are both just big vinyl nerds, and they argued all night about the difference between punk and new wave and, you know, Blondie versus the Ramones. And I enjoyed their conversation. It was really fascinating. But I kind of felt like at the end of the day, it's music. Like, what, it's not about kind of putting everything in its different pigeonholes. And yeah, that can be very fascinating. But the point is the music, right? Like, to play the instruments and to play the records and to, you know, just do it. So, you know, I think that sometimes we can get carried away in sort of the historianism of the occult, and forget about just the sheer fun and ease of just trying this stuff. I mean, it's not that hard to keep a dream journal. It's not that hard to draw a mandala. You know, these are easy things to try out.
Well, and that's why it's so important, though, and this is something that I stress a lot, is that there's this idea that belief is necessary. Like, I feel like throughout religion, spirituality, like any paranormal or cult thing, there seems to be this underlying theme that there's believers and then there's non-believers, right? And people right. like to kind of split it up through that. But I always stress, no belief is necessary, only action and participation. Like, you can try it right now. Like, do it now instead of everyone just worrying, like, oh, I don't believe in that, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. I think that belief doesn't impact what the facts are, what the reality
Correct.
Is. But your what you're noticing will impact what the facts are. And if you are somebody that believes that all of this stuff is baloney, you're not going to bother to look, you know?
Right.
Like if you, I can imagine, like if I didn't believe that that soda pop cans would ever get me a nickel, I might never try returning them for a nickel, you know? And it's a weird analogy, but unless you had a guy just walked by with a cart outside, unless you have the belief to try something, to get curious and try it out, then you're not going to experience it.
Well, it's funny you're talking about history and kind of moving away from history in kind of ideas about magic and all the layers and feeling like you have to study it before you do it and things like that. What it reminds me of is something I mentioned at the beginning of the show, the way in which your work and the practices themselves and the kind of attitude towards the practices that you represent is also part of another history, which is the way in which artists in particular have used techniques that are developed in relationship to the occult. They're interested in the occult, they're attracted to it, but they're doing them in a different way. And, you know, one of your exercises is the flâneur. And the flâneur, of course, is this wonderful figure. It comes out of 19th century Bohemian France. It sort of speaks to that sensibility of the emerging Bohemian sensibility, which really in many ways comes about in the late 19th century under the conditions of industrialism and familiar conditions of modernity. And these people were like, wow, we want to explore consciousness and not just get stuck in the rational mind frame. And we can see the appeal of the insane, the occult, but we don't want either of those. We want to like kind of get nearby. And how do we like cultivate that thing? And there's tons of practices, Dada, the surrealists, all this stuff. And by including the flâneur there as one of the practices now, is it also reminds me that there's this whole other kind of history of more kind of available, experimental, creative, let's just see what happens kind of approach to the mysteries that is in many ways, I think, our modern magic. That's what it means to do magic in our contemporary era. You can do ceremonial magic or get into shamanism or all these things. That's part of the picture too, but that there is something that's specifically of our weird modern industrial civilization that has this kind of playfulness, this kind of immediacy, this kind of emphasis on creativity and discovery. So I really liked the flâneur, and that's also one that I've often talked about as well. The kind of like the dream walk is also what I call it, where you walk through an unfamiliar city as if you were in a dream, following the most symbolically rich or enigmatic things, you know, a glimpse of an open doorway or a strange statue or the name of the street sign. You know, you start to read it as a dream, and there you are. You're in that liminal space just walking down the street.
Yeah, it's a beautiful way to participate in the world, and it's a lot easier to do when you're not in your hometown. When you travel, suddenly everything, if you're in a different city, everything suddenly becomes a little bit mysterious, and you'll notice that the world seems more poetic. You'll see those candlelit doorways, and you'll hear somebody playing the piano off in the distance, and the stars have just a little bit more shine. But the truth is that we are always, our hometown is somebody else's foreign city, and I think that a lot of these ideas and techniques, the trick is kind of to treat your own life where you are now and see it through the eyes of a tourist, almost, to try and see the world anew. And one of the techniques in DIY magic is to try to get lost in your hometown. I recommend using a bicycle because you can take more turns faster than just walking, unless you walk really, really far. But the idea in the book is get a map of a city you're not in, say Paris, and try to get from, pick a spot on the map and say, okay, I'm going to go to the Eiffel Tower, say, and then follow the directions that the map would give you. And so you're kind of taking this random course in whatever city you happen to be in. And the idea is to get kind of lost and then find yourself in a neck of the woods that you wouldn't normally take. And it will change your perception of your hometown, of your neighborhood, and of your day.
Yeah, that's
well,
so key.
It's interesting the role of crisis that plays in that, too. Like, a lot of the shamanic traditions, the big message is you have to be a little uncomfortable to make yourself pay attention. And that's a big part of the gift of pain or the gift of looking at these things that we don't like to look at. Like you said, the ability to look at the schizophrenic person, to engage in them, what that does is now you're engaging with a part that you used to, like, block off, like almost one of your horse blinders would go on. So by forcing your gaze into an area to look into the darkness, it, like, lets you see more of reality. So when you actually include the whole spectrum of things that are there, that's such a good way to immediately alter your perception. But for some reason, when people feel comfortable, like in your hometown, you know, you're like, oh, I know where that street goes. I know what's down that street. Oh, that's Susie who lives down the street. And you're not like, yeah,
that's
like,
our day-to-day lives. Is it's like, I know that street. I know where this, you know, I know what I do at 2 o'clock and at 5 o'clock. And we know the routine of the day that we inhabit. So much. And so to try to shake ourselves free of that, I think, is uncomfortable and wonderful at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's why I really appreciate that you include one of the quickest, easiest, and most incontrovertible ways to introduce that little bit of crisis into the ordinary, mundane reality, which is memento mori, that we're going to die. And the way you approach that is really great because it is a practice, you know, and it is, you know, in traditional religions, particularly in Buddhism or in, you know, Christianity with the meditating on the skull or whatever, there is the sense, but rather than do it with a directed religious meaning, like, I'm going to die, therefore I should stop pursuing worldly pleasures and, you know, only adhere to this book or what this priest is saying. Instead, it's still such an overwhelming, impossible fact, this absolute fact that we cannot ever wrap our heads around, even when it's right in our face, that thought, that real engagement with that reality can disturb us, open us up, make us more tender, make us see through the demands of the day. But it doesn't have an answer. It doesn't lead you one place or another necessarily. You don't know where you're going to go. It's an experimental practice to remind oneself of one's death, and that's something that I've been doing for 20 years, and it still keeps on giving in different ways. And so I was really happy you included that, and also as a way to acknowledge that it's, you know, it's not all, you know, unicorns and rainbows, that it's, you know, there's a whole gamut of spaces.
But the interesting thing, Eric, is that when we do look at that, when we kind of gaze death in the face, it's very life-affirming, you know? And if we try to make it all unicorns and rainbows all the time, we're going to get, like, sugar overload and feel sick, I think. But when we balance it with looking at the things that scare us, at death, at decay, when we balance it out, I think it's tonic for us. It's healthy for us. I mean, like I was saying earlier, I believe I came very close to being hit by a car late last night, but for some reason I turned around, I took a different path, and I saw that car smash through where I would have been standing. I feel great today because I'm very happy to be alive at all. Because I'm like, wow, that could have been it. And when you remember that, it makes you take life not for granted, which, you know, is so easy to do, to take everything for granted.
And what else do you do on your and when you realize, like, oh, today is humdrum day, I'm not feeling the magic, I'm kind of stuck in the routine. What are some of the things you do to shake yourself up?
We were talking about the flaneur. I think that walking is the easiest of all spells. I mean, you know, the easiest of ways to change. Anytime I'm getting humdrum, I take a long walk. Over my door is Salvatore Ambulando over my office door, so that anytime I find myself stuck and staring around in space, my eyes drift to that. I'm like, oh yeah, it's time to take a walk. So that's a really huge one for me. What else? Meditation is very grounding. I mean, the things that I return to again and again, music, meditation, walking. Yeah, I don't know if they sound that magical, but I feel like magic is this giant toolbox with dozens and dozens, hundreds and hundreds of approaches and ideas. And once you're familiar with the toolbox, you know what you need on a given day. And 9 times out of 10, you're just going to reach for the hammer and the tape measure, the basic tools. Every once in a while, you might reach for something more out there. You might say, well, I need to do, you know, chakra sound meditation today, or it's time for a visit to the flotation tank, or it's time to really go on a solitary vision quest out in the woods. But a lot of times you're just going to reach for the hammer, you know, to fix the most basic things that you want to tackle. And for me, there are things like taking an aimless walk without a destination, or doing some yoga, and those things, I put them in the same toolbox, and often I reach for the simplest because they're tried and true.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. And also, I like how you have, we just got a couple of minutes here left, but also, you know, you include some variations of things we do all the time, you know, including, you know, food and drink and caffeine, and, you know, there's all of these sort of intimate parts of the way we modulate our own metabolism that can be played with along similar lines. That when we shift that away from habit, it's very powerful.
Yeah. Sometimes you want magic mushrooms, and sometimes you just want a strong cup of coffee. You know, they're all, you know, it's all, they're all available.
Well, I like the way you also emphasize that, like, you know, there's one strong cup of coffee, and then there's three strong cups of coffee,
right.
And then you're definitely you know, flying. So there's all sorts of variations at hand.
Yeah, there was one part that the new edition doesn't have, where I talked about whiskey and Adderall as being writing tools. And I think the publishers are wisely like, you don't want to put those two things in conjunction in the same paragraph. People might get the wrong idea and take them together. So, but yeah, there's a plethora of stuff out there, and it's not just the drugs that we normally think of as drugs that, you know, if I get my sleep schedule out of whack, I will take melatonin, and I find it works great, you know, and that's a powerful thing to have without having to, you know, go get some kind of prescription drug. But if we're running low on time, I wanted to ask about, we have a connection in with Ron Reggie, who I know is a student of yours, and he's got an illustration in DIY magic. So I just wanted to mention that connection, which I thought was really kind of interesting.
Super magical.
Yeah.
Well, I did want to say that there are some great illustrations in the book too, and that really makes it much more accessible. And they're a fresh kind of underground comic kind of feel, rather than like you know, sort of traditional illustrations of how to do things. They're more impressionistic, and it really has a lot to do with the book. But we're going to have to wrap it up there. Once again, we've been talking to Anthony Alvarado about DIY Magic, which is a text I highly recommend. It. Very fun thing. So, Anthony, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Yeah, thanks so much, guys. It's been a pleasure.
All right, well, good luck with the book stuff.
Okay, thank you.
All right, from me and Maja to all you out there, keep your minds open.
Yeah.